Hikatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Hikatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling someone pretty monumental, William Shakespeare. But we're trying to get past the, you know, the high school reading lists, the romantic ideas.
Yeah, we're going for a really rigorous look at the man himself. And we're using Sir Stanley Wells' scholarship as our guide. He's one of the top experts out there.
Absolutely. We want to separate the real historical figure from, well, from the myth.
Exactly. Wells actually has a term for it, bardolatry.
Yeah.
This tendency to almost worship Shakespeare, treat him like he wasn't quite human.
Right. Instead, we're looking for the ambitious professional, the craftsman who knew his trade inside and out, and who, let's be honest, was working in a tough commercial theater scene in London.
That's the goal, to find those aha moments, the things that make him feel less like this, you know, untouchable genius on a pedestal.
And more like a real working playwright, someone whose skill was practical, applied, maybe even find the operating manual behind the genius.
Well, if anyone can give us that, it's Stanley Wells. I mean, his credentials, they're just top tier in Shakespeare studies.
He's honorary president of the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust, right?
Yeah.
And led the Shakespeare Institute for years.
Emeritus professor there, yeah. And maybe the biggest thing for understanding his authority, he was the general editor for the Oxford Shakespeare, the complete works.
Wow. So he didn't just study Shakespeare. He was responsible for the definitive modern edition of the plays. That takes incredible depth.
It really does. And what makes his take so useful for, you know, for everyone listening is how he connects the dots. He doesn't just do literary analysis, though he does that brilliantly.
He understands the theater side, too.
Exactly. The practical side. How these plays actually worked on stage back then. He sees them as performance texts, not just poems.
Okay, so that balance.
Mm-hmm.
Literature and performance keeps it grounded in reality.
Totally. It's all evidence-based. He's really focused on the historical facts, not the later legends.
So let's dive into his main idea then. What's the core thesis?
It's pretty straightforward, actually, and maybe a bit surprising. Wells argues we have to see Shakespeare as a pragmatic, ambitious professional.
A professional first.
Yeah. Deeply embedded in the, well, the business side of the London theater world. He knew how to work the system, how to succeed commercially.
That's different from the usual image. So how does Wells build that case?
He starts with the hard evidence, the few but really significant biographical facts we have. You know, marriage records, property deals, mentions in financial documents.
The concrete stuff.
Right. And then he immediately links that to the context.
Mm.
What were the theaters like? How did the business work? It makes Shakespeare feel much more, well, tangible. Less like a ghost.
And then he moves on to the works themselves.
Yes, he tracks his development, starts with the poems, which were actually key to his early reputation, especially with the elite.
Oh, interesting. Not the plays first.
Not for his high status reputation, no. Then he covers the comedies, histories, the big tragedies, and those later kind of strange romances.
And he wraps up by tackling the authorship question. That old chestnut.
He does, and he pretty methodically takes it apart. We can get into that later.
So why do the plays last if he was so tied to a specific time in business?
Well, Wells argues it's because of that foundation, his mastery of language, obviously, but also his incredible empathy for human nature. He just got people.
And the plays themselves are just adaptable.
Hugely adaptable. They speak to generation after generation. But Wells shows that universality came from his very specific, grounded work. When you strip away the myth, the actual achievement is even more impressive.
Okay, let's zoom in on the man himself. Those early years, the lost years, are famously murky. What does Wells think is, you know, most likely? He avoids the wild speculation.
Oh, yeah, he definitely sticks to the plausible. He kind of dismisses the more, let's say, romantic theories, Shakespeare the soldier or the lawyer or off sailing somewhere.
Right.
He suggests it's more probable he was doing something like maybe being a schoolmaster for a while, or perhaps traveling with an acting company before he really made his name in London.
So something that fits with a literate, ambitious young man from the provinces.
Exactly. The known facts, even if they're a bit thin, point towards someone educated, driven, wanting to make his mark.
Which brings up that central point. You mentioned the businessman aspect.
Yeah.
How does Wells square the, you know, the soaring poetry with the practical need to make a living?
That's really key to Wells's whole perspective. He insists Shakespeare wasn't some starving artist just writing for art's sake. He was incredibly shrewd.
Oh, so?
The big thing was becoming a shareholder in his acting company, First the Lord Chamberlain's men, then later they became the King's men.
So he wasn't just paid per play. He owned a piece of the company.
Precisely. He shared in the profits. That gave him a level of financial security and maybe creative freedom that, frankly, most other playwrights just didn't have.
Ah, okay. So the business side actually enabled the art, in a way.
You could definitely argue that. And he didn't just rely on the theater income. He made smart investments, especially back in Stratford. Bought New Place, which was one of the biggest houses in town.
So he retired a wealthy man.
A successful, wealthy, respected gentleman. His success came through his professional and commercial skill, not despite it.
That really grounds him. And it makes sense that his environment, the theater itself, would shape the work. Wells talks a lot about the Globe, right? What was that actually like?
Oh, it was an amazing space, but probably not what people imagine. Think open air, likely circular or polygonal. Tiered galleries for those who could afford seats.
And the stage.
It was a thrust stage. It stuck way out into the open yard area where the poorer spectators, the groundlings, stood. They were literally surrounding the actors on three sides.
Wow, that sounds intense. Close up and personal.
And incredibly. Probably noisy, definitely interactive, a real mix of people packed in there. And Wells makes a crucial point about this setup. Because there wasn't elaborate scenery and no fancy lighting effects like we have today, the language had to do all the heavy lifting.
Ah, so the words painted the picture. The setting, the mood.
Everything. Time of day, location, atmosphere, even the inner thoughts of the characters. That constraint, that lack of tech, actually forced Shakespeare's language to become incredibly rich and evocative. It had to be.
That makes so much sense. Okay, shifting to the works themselves, you mentioned something surprising. His early literary fame wasn't from the plays.
That's right. In the early 1590s, there were plague outbreaks that shut the London theaters down for long stretches.
Right, I've heard about that.
So Shakespeare, needing income and probably wanting to build his reputation beyond the slightly rowdier playhouse crowd, turned to writing narrative poems.
Like Venus and Adonis.
Exactly. Venus and Adonis, The Rape of Lucrece. These were seen as more highbrow, more serious literature at the time, and they were hugely successful.
And they got him noticed by important people.
Yes. Crucially, they helped him secure patronage from the Earl of Southampton. That connection was really important. It established him as a serious literary figure, not just another playwright churning out scripts.
That shows real strategic thinking, doesn't it? Adapting to the market.
Absolutely. He knew where the prestige and maybe safer money was.
Right.
And Wells sees a similar complexity in the sonnets. He warns us not to read them like a straightforward diary.
Not a simple love triangle story.
No. I mean, the fair youth, the dark lady, they're fascinating figures, but Wells emphasizes the poems are brilliant, complex explorations of themes like time, beauty, love, betrayal. It's art, sophisticated art, not just autobiography.
Okay. And then came the great tragedies, Hamlet, Lear, Othello, Macbeth. How does Wells frame these iconic plays?
He sees them as more than just powerful stories. They're profound philosophical investigations. Deep dives into existence, morality, the nature of suffering.
Case studies in being human.
Kind of, yeah. He points out the incredible psychological depth. Think of Hamlet's indecision, his existential angst, or the sheer, almost unbearable bleakness of King Lear, you know, the betrayal, the sense that the universe just doesn't care.
They ask the big questions.
The biggest questions. And they resonate because those questions are timeless, even if the settings are specific.
And you mentioned earlier, these weren't written in a vacuum. They were for his acting company, right? For specific actors.
Yes, very much so. Wells highlights the importance of Richard Burbage, the company's lead actor. He originated all those great tragic roles, Hamlet, Lear, Othello.
So Shakespeare was likely writing with Burbage's talents in mind.
Almost certainly. It underscores that these were practical, collaborative creations for performance, not just solitary literary efforts.
Which brings us back to that authorship question. Wells seems pretty definitive about it. Why is he so dismissive of the idea someone else, Bacon, Marlowe, Oxford, wrote the plays?
He cuts right through it. He essentially calls it snobbery, intellectual snobbery.
Snobbery, how so?
It's the underlying refusal, he argues, to believe that a man from Stratford, middle class, without a university education, could possibly have been that brilliant. It's a kind of social prejudice looking for a historical conspiracy.
Where's the evidence for Shakespeare himself?
Wells says the evidence for William Shakespeare of Stratford, the contemporary mentions, the financial records, Ben Jonson's famous tribute is concrete, contemporary, and frankly overwhelming compared to the speculative cases for the other candidates.
Okay, that reframing Shakespeare, the skilled professional, deeply rooted in his time and trade, feels like a really useful way to approach him. How can we apply that perspective?
Well, one immediate application is just better critical thinking, especially about information we get today. Wells's careful dismantling of the authorship myth, sorting fact from speculation, identifying bias like snobbery, that's a great model.
So apply that same skepticism to, say, conspiracy theories or misinformation we see online. Look for the evidence, question the motive.
Exactly. It's about media literacy. And a second big application, I think, is developing empathy.
How does understanding him as a craftsman help with empathy?
Because Wells focuses on the psychological depth that Shakespeare achieved within the constraints of his craft. When you really dig into characters like Hamlet, with all his contradictions, or Lady Macbeth and her guilt, you're getting these incredibly complex case studies in human motivation.
So engaging with that complexity helps us understand real people better. People aren't simple heroes or villains.
Precisely. It trains you to see the nuances, the internal conflicts. It can genuinely foster greater empathy in how you view others.
And that links to a third theme, doesn't it? The idea of embracing ambiguity. Wells seems to suggest Shakespeare often leaves things unresolved.
He absolutely does. Think about Shylock in The Merchant of Venice. Is he a caricature villain or a victim of prejudice pushed too far? Shakespeare doesn't give easy answers.
He makes the audience wrestle with it.
Yes. And in a world that increasingly pushes for black and white thinking, learning to sit with that kind of complexity, to analyze contradiction without needing a simple resolution, that's an incredibly valuable skill. Shakespeare models that for us.
If I had to pick one quote or idea from Wells that really sums it up, it might be his insistence that to read Shakespeare without imagining him on the stage is to miss the point entirely.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah. It emphasizes the plays as living, breathing events, not just static text.
Right. They need performance.
For me, a key quote is actually from Ben Jonson, Shakespeare's contemporary, but Wells uses it to make his point. He was not of an age, but for all time.
The famous line.
Yes, but Wells shows the paradox. Shakespeare achieved that timelessness because he was so deeply rooted in his own age. His universality came from his specific practical mastery of his craft in Elizabethan London.
So my big takeaway, reflecting on this, is that understanding the real-world context, the business, the collaboration, the stagecraft, actually makes Shakespeare's genius seem more incredible, not less.
I agree. It wasn't magic. It was genius applied under pressure within a system. It was transformative work done in a commercial setting.
And for you listening, the most valuable thing might be this shift in perspective. Shakespeare isn't some dusty old monument you have to appreciate. Wells gives you the tools to connect with him authentically.
Yeah, armed with facts, not just myths. And once you have that grounding, you start to see his influence everywhere in our language, our stories, how we even think about what it means to be human. He becomes a living cultural force again.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akasha Foundation.